Hi, Aleš. What was your first computer?
Spectrum 48ZX. Is that correct?
I don't know. You have to know what was your first computer. But
it's so back that, I mean, actually, I have two older brothers, and they're the ones that got it when I was still really, really small. So.
But was the with the colorful rubber keys, right?
Yes. It's like the small black one with the rubber keys.
Yeah. This one was great. I had the successor of that, but I wanted to have this one as well. This was and what you did with the computer at the beginning?
We played games, lots of games.
Actually, what was your favorite game?
Chucky Egg, I think.
Chucky Egg? Never heard about that.
Yeah, I mean, you were collecting eggs, and I think the nostriches were somehow trying to catch you.
Mm-hmm.
You're able to jump up and down. I mean, it's like an arcade game.
Okay. And you started to do something else than games with the computer, or was just about gaming back then?
I mean, I was like an experiment from my brothers. They experimented on me. So I started programming really at the early age, programming in BASIC. Actually, just doing things on that Spectrum computer. And then, I mean, we actually quickly
What do you wanted to achieve? What do you wanted to implement in BASIC back then?
At the beginning, it was just pretty much probably the same things as everybody wants, like a program that when you input two numbers, it does plus or minus or whatever, and then it somehow it outputted random equations, and you had to solve them.
Wow. Yeah. This is not what everybody wants, you know. At the beginning is hello world, and it's good enough.
Yeah.
But back then there was no hello world, interestingly. So I remember someone mentioned hello world. This hello world was, I didn't knew about hello world back then. So my first...
Yeah. I think hello world was much, much later on.
Yeah, exactly. So my first is printing something on the screen. I don't even remember with in a loop. This is what I think what everybody does, right? With go to.
Yeah, I think probably from 1 to 10, and then just output the numbers.
Yeah, exactly. So you started with calculator, which is already advanced, so not bad. And did it work from the beginning?
Yeah, it did work. I mean, both of my brothers were into computers, and they were already, I mean. At least the second one, he was pretty much advanced. I mean, he was doing interesting games on his own already. You can still find them online, his games.
Really? Still available?
Yeah. I mean, with the emulators that we have now, I think you can still install his games and play them.
Were actually popular, his games? Or he sold his games, or was it like...
Yeah, I mean, back in there, it was still Yugoslavia, right? And... He was actually selling, you sold the games on a cassette, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people somehow ordered his cassettes through mail, and he sent them. I don't know how actually he got paid, but probably people sent some money. I mean, it wasn't like you could flick the money, right? Like you can do it now, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, I need to ask him how the actual transactions went on, because probably it's like a... You had to trust the guy that he will send you back the money, or he had to trust you so that you will send him the cassette, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is actually a great story. So it was like early e-commerce, you know?
Yeah.
Software as a service.
Yeah, but I think it was, the thing was that there was like a Yugoslavian magazine that went around, and you were able to publish in that magazine, and you were able to publish like in... Ad, I'm doing this and this, and then I think you can even describe the games. Like it was like two popular games. One was like sort of like esports, so you're doing different sports like long jump, running, and the second one was an arrow game. So there was like a moving target, and you had to shoot arrows at the moving target, and it depended how much. I mean, there was some wind or some other conditions into calculated into that, and you had to somehow calculate that into when you shot and how fast. I mean, it depended how strong you hold the button down. That is how fast the arrow was going out.
This is what your brother did, the games.
Yes.
What were the names, you remember, of the game?
I think it was like the Black Arrow, and the first one, I can't remember. So.
Okay, Black Arrow is already cool. Operation Black Arrow.
Yeah.
Okay, and what about you? So you started, so the calculator worked. What was the next, you know, assignment from your brothers?
From the from basic, I moved quite quickly to Pascal.
Okay. So did Pascal run on ZX Spectrum?
No, I mean, Pascal, I think I ran Pascal on, I mean, we quickly bought, I think it was like 1985, 86, when we got our first PC computer.
Wow.
How smuggled it from Germany.
Okay.
Yeah. We went to, the whole family drove to Nuremberg. And we bought the, we already bought the computer in advance. So we just had to pick it up. And then we had to somehow smuggle it under our seats and so on. So it wasn't as easy then, right?
Why it was not allowed to bring a Western computer to Yugoslavia?
I think it wasn't mostly because of the price, right? We had to pay customs. It wasn't well customs, okay. Right? I think you could buy it. It wasn't like that we were like behind an iron curtain. Yugoslavia was quite open about that, so we were able easily to travel around. But I think the customs would be a lot of money as well, right?
Mm-hmm. What is it, German custom or Yugoslavian customs?
Yeah, I don't know how it that went, right, between Germany and Austria, but definitely between Austria and Yugoslavia, right?
Oh, Austria, and okay, yeah. That's interesting.
I mean, we had to cross, first we had to cross German-Austrian border, and we had to cross Austrian-Yugoslavian border.
Yeah. Okay, but there was, I assume, no monitor, because monitor would be, you know, harder to the display to smuggle, right?
Yeah, there was monitor, but you somehow, I mean, as a family, didn't look as suspicious, right? It didn't even, it was just, I don't know, my father went picking it up and driving along in the car, probably they would turn the car around. And at that time, or I think the second computer we also...
No, but the first one, you remember the brand? This was interesting.
Yeah, I don't know what was it, but it was like the old, how it was, I think it was XT, it was an 80.
There was an XT80 or something like this, right?
Yeah. And then we quickly bought a 80.
But you bought it on MediaMark or what in Germany? But because it was an interesting story. I mean...
I can't remember the mark, but I think it was somehow assembled. And just then we bought it from somebody, some shop in Nuremberg.
Okay.
And we took it in after a few, I think it was like 1 or 2 years, we went ahead because the 80s were coming out. And instead of it, there was like an 83, 80, 386, right? And we actually bought a 486. And remember playing Tetris, you had to turn, there was like a button, turbo or not.
Exactly.
No turbo. Yeah, and with the 486, it was so fast that you couldn't play it with a turbo on or something like that.
Exactly. The turbo button, I remember. And what you did with the first one? So you programmed Pascal. What was the most interesting Pascal program?
I started with, I think it's like, you call it in Hangman, right? You had to guess the word, right? And then if you didn't... every time you missed a character, right, or a letter in the word, a part of the hang, how's it called, like the stuff when you hang people, right? That was somehow, I draw a part of it where you eventually you hang the guy, right? Mm-hmm. If you missed too much letters before guessing the word, you got hanged.
And how much time you spend with programming computers back then?
A lot, right? Okay, I was still playing sports. I mean, I played basketball, tennis, and so on. But, yeah, I think mostly in those winter times when there was not there was dark quite quickly. And but yeah, I mean, probably learning. I mean, there was already books that you can learn from. Uh-huh. Right? There was no internet back then, but there are already books, right? Even translated to Slovenian, I think. But I mean, in English back then, I mean, you could at least, it was like only programming, right? You didn't have to read a lot.
Yeah.
Think in text. Yeah. So you can learn from the examples and so on. But yeah, I mean, I did spend so doing that. And then I was in school, and then we had the lessons in school as well, programming, about programming. So I was doing, I remember I did a, like a periodic system with, you can type in what's the element under number 10 or something like that, or how many electrons or blah, 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 and orbits it has and so on. And then what was next? Did a simulation of how you can shoot the ball and and so on.
Okay. And you spend a lot of time with Turbo Pascal, or you move on to a different language then?
Yeah, back when in high school, at the end of high school, moved to C, right?
Uh-huh.
And then in early years of faculty, we did C++. I mean, I liked C++.
So you studied computer science?
Mathematics.
Wow, mathematics, not bad. But you moved from Turbo Pascal to C. So do you had a goal? Would you like to implement, I don't know, a game or a drawing application, or what was your idea?
I moved in between. I think I did what was like Visual Basic, right? Mm-hmm. Which was also already nice. And I did a online game. Mm-hmm. You can actually connect a couple of people in between, and you're able to play cards. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, tarot, if you know it. Mm-hmm. Against so you're able to either three players or four players, you're able to play tarot in between. Right? You're able to connect through modems, and one of the computer was like a server, and the other were just normal players. But C++. I mean, mostly I was in mathematics at that days, so mostly did some mathematical stuff with it.
Okay, so you played less games, and it just was about programming, right?
Yeah, at one point I think when I went to high school, somehow I stopped playing games. I mean, before I was playing, I really liked, of course, like everybody, Wolfenstein and Doom and Prince of Persia and all those, what was LucasArts games when you had to...
You played actually Wing Commander?
Yeah, I remember playing it, but I mean, I didn't like it as much.
Uh-huh. I knew someone had it, and I was really interested in how it works, but it looked interesting, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I remember Wolfenstein when it came, and it came like on 10 small diskettes, right? And you installed it.
This was like Doom or something, right? This was the predecessor of Quake or Doom, the Wolfenstein.
Yeah.
Like the first 3D game.
Wolfenstein was the before Doom, like then after, I think it was like Wolfenstein 1, Wolfenstein 2, and then it was Doom, which was already sort of like 3D. I mean, even Wolfenstein was like a 3D game, but like a more octagonal 3D, right? Mm-hmm. Doom was already nice and polished.
Okay, so you studied mathematics and you used C, and so what happened then? So mathematics already interesting. So you enjoyed mathematics, studying mathematics, or
yes, a lot.
Oh, really? Yes. That's interesting.
Yeah.
And how hard was it? You had to learn a lot, or was it like?
No, I mean, I was quite gifted for mathematics. So, mostly. I mean, I was like a serious student, so I went to the fact like for the lessons all the time, and following closely what's going on. And I was studying throughout the year, so I didn't I wasn't leaving things behind. So And there was like, the nice thing was you had, I mean, we call it colloquiums. So it was every quarter there was one, right? So you could do things, you didn't have to do it all at once at the end, but you were able to do it throughout the year, right? It's like less material to study, less material to, to learn, right? So, I mean, I was doing it throughout the year. So at the end of the year, at the end of the study year, you're just oral exams, and that was it.
What was the hardest topic in mathematics for you?
We had mechanics, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you, I mean, it's like tensors and all those, how you move like normal Newton formulas into different, because you have to somehow, to solve some of the, for example, for the liquids and so on, you have to transform the normal equations, normal formulas into different space or environment, right? So the formulas somehow change through tensors into different.
Almost physics, sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, the tensors was a lot of mathematics, right? But the rest of the stuff, yes, was physics. So
okay.
Well, yeah. But that was the hardest, right? That was the rest of it, not as much, at least not for me, but mechanics, that was pretty, pretty hard. I don't think it's hard for everybody. So all the friends that I had from the faculty, everybody was, there was almost nobody that would say like, oh yeah, that's easy. Mechanics were easy for me.
Mm-hmm. And calculus was easy?
Yeah, I mean, you had to follow what was going on, but we had good professors, really, like an old school professors, which did, I mean, they were already doing that stuff for 30 years plus, so they really knew how to present the topic.
Right? Mm-hmm. And what was the next language after C?
C++, but I didn't do much C++. I mean, I liked it, but you could tell it was hard because nobody else almost like, I mean, I enjoyed it because it was, you had to be so exact on what you were doing, right? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you could leak memory really, really fast, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, the constructs of constructors and destructors and pointers and so on, it's not easy to get your head around, right? But eventually I did through C and so on. But yeah, of course, then Java was becoming more and more popular, so I moved into Java. And
during study, so you wanted to, you know, implement the or use it for calculations or something serious, or what was the why you started Java?
At one point, I mean, I was thinking either to do some academia, living academia life, or just I was involved with programming from the early age, and okay, let's see how it goes, and then. But in the middle of my third year, someone said, okay, let's see how the real, like, how real programming looks like if you want to make a living out of it. And I joined one of probably biggest Slovenia's IT companies, at least programming-wise and Java-wise, and they were like a big Java shop. Mm-hmm. So I had to learn Java, but from previous, I mean,
Which version was it? Java version, remember?
1.2.
Whoa.
Yeah. I mean, I actually looked at Java in high school at one point when it was still applets and so on. But it somehow didn't feel like what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like I was already on version 1.0 in the high school, just looking at it, right? Uh-huh. And then I remember that even the IDE, I don't know what was I using, but I think it came with Java. It wasn't good. So somehow it turned me off.
NetBeans could be. NetBeans, or there was a checkbox was built in. It was like a
J Visual Studio, something like that.
Java Studio Workshop. There was Java Studio Workshop and Visual Studio. Right. Yeah, it was from Microsoft.
I mean, I remember NetBeans from later on, but it was something else, and somehow turned me off. So I didn't look at it till, like I said, I didn't look into Java till my third year of faculty, right?
There was a Java workshop in Java Studio. And the workshop was like the IDE, and the studio was drag and drop of Java Beans. There were two from some microsystems back then, 1997.
Yeah, something like that,
Okay. So
I joined, and then I had to, I mean, they were like a big Java shop.
So you work for them or
what? Yeah. I mean, like a student job, right?
Uh-huh.
I went to the university in the morning and then moved in the afternoon. I went and did some, I mean, the work that they assigned to me. Right? And then my funny thing, like my first thing was actually a Corba, using Corba to do a FAT client communication between FAT client and a server.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to learn Corba as well.
One of my first projects as well, Corba. Yeah. Interesting. And it was also JDK 1.2 back then. So I evaluated JDK 1.2 and we evaluated different various Corba orbs, like Orbix, Visigenix, and JACorp came later. But Corba was big back then.
Yeah, I mean, remember we... I think there was a free version of an orb, right? Uh-huh. But there was also, I mean, because we had to, I mean, but that one didn't work really well, I think. And so, yeah, I don't remember, but I remember the company was paying for an orb. So we had we were using orb, which we had to pay for it.
Right? There was a Visigenix and Orbix, I think two orbs. And JACorp was free. And I think JACorp was used in JBoss later, right? JACorp.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
To do the early
and what do you implement? You remember the app?
We had it was an telco app, so it's like a FAT client to punch in the users for a mobile company. Mm-hmm. So that it depended on it had all in one. Of course, if you were a super admin, you could see everything, all the subscriptions of and all the stuff from probably all the users.
Mm-hmm.
If you are just like a guy behind the counter when users when people came in and they mm-hmm. wanted to subscribe to and create get a new mobile phone, you probably just saw some of the stuff and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you enjoyed that, the Java experience?
I mean, yeah, it was a interesting learning experience. So,
And you stick with Java then through university or what happened after university?
Can you say again?
So what happened after university? So you...
Yeah, then I was doing this like it was third year and fourth year. And then from my hometown, a good friend of my brother's, he somehow created his own company.
Uh-huh.
And my brother somehow said, my smallest brother, he's quite good at it. He already works. And he somehow persuaded me to move from that big IT company to his small, that in those days it wasn't called a startup. It was just like a small company, right?
Interesting. Uh-huh.
So I was probably employee number one. And uh-huh. I took a good friend of mine and also a classmate from high school and from university with me to that company. So, and there was an old school guy who knew something about databases.
Mm-hmm.
And we started a company which was doing energy consumption analysis applications.
Huh. That would be interesting even right now.
Yeah, still. Yeah, so, I mean, I liked it. I mean, I moved there because I knew, on the ugly side, I knew I was on my own. And mm-hmm. probably that was also a good side. I was on my own, right? So I was able to do whatever we could. I mean, whatever you wanted. And somehow pushed into the sea and we had to swim. So,
uh-huh.
And we somehow managed to implement all the stuff that we needed and wanted to implement, right?
So uh-huh. In Java.
That's what I did after. That's what somehow persuaded me not to pursue an academic career.
Uh-huh.
Because the programming at that time, I was involved in all this energy consumption application, like a really huge one. And me and my friend, we mostly did all of it. And the guy who did databases, he designed how the tables of what up from the application should look like, and we connected to those tables.
What database was it? Oracle?
It was actually no. I have no money, so we had a free version of Microsoft database.
That's interesting choice. Yeah. Not MySQL, not Postgres was early. There was a predecessor of Postgres, maybe. And was it Java?
Yes, it was Java. So
it was a JDBC. What technology stack was it back then?
It was, of course, Tomcat. And at first, we had our own implementations for most of the things, right? As we knew. But even then, I think that was in 2003 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I think Spring was already around. I mean, mm-hmm. It started with even less than version 1. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I liked it a lot, right? It was really properly documented. It solved the problems that we were solving ourselves before. Mm-hmm. I mean, with how to do transactions, how to integrate with struts and all sorts of other things, right? And how to connect to database more efficiently throughout the connection pool and having those JDBC templates and so on. At first, I remember we were using our own implementation of sort of entity beans, but it took too much. And then we moved to Castor. Castor was...
but Castor was an XML serializer, right?
Castor was, I think you somehow described your stuff. I guess it was through XML. I don't remember because I quickly learned about Hibernate, right? Uh-huh. So I remember during the summer time when most of the people were off and there was no huge demand for changes in the app. And I had peace and quiet in the office, so I went and re-implemented and threw Castor away and re-implemented everything on top of Hibernate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Castor was also big, I remember, right? So I have to look it up, so almost forgot about that.
Yeah, Castor was before Hibernate, right? It was okay, but when Hibernate came in, you can see that you could tell that Hibernate was a nicer design, right? Nice. Everything was nicer, right? Mm-hmm.
And who were your clients for the app?
The biggest energy consumers in Slovenia, right? You have Slovenian railways. You have what they do is they do aluminium, right? Mm-hmm. The ones that do aluminium, the ones that do iron, mm-hmm. the ones that something else, and then
this is crazy. So the colleague of your brother, the friend of your brother, so he had somehow connections to the energy sector, because how you could sell, a small company could sell solution,
The owner, the guy, like friend of my brother's, he was already like in a similar company before, which did SCADA systems, so that he could monitor what was going on. But he could tell that those SCADA systems were really, really expensive, right? Mm-hmm. And they weren't as flexible as you wanted, right? And every time you wanted to add something to the SCADA system, probably had to contact the ones that, like the SCADA providers, and mm-hmm. they will rip you off. And the thing is, what those big energy consumers, what they have to do is they have to tell a year in advance how much they will actually consume, right? Uh-huh. So that, because you can imagine, right? If you're like a railway or you are like a big aluminium, you need a lot of electricity. Uh-huh. And if you just somehow you would pick too much or just take too much, and then probably you would take too much electricity or some gas or whatever, uh-huh. so that like the normal households wouldn't have it, right? And what they did before was, and that's how we came to have the business. What they had before was they had their own accounting services that they would punch those numbers from, I don't know, from the bills or whatever into Excel sheets. And they would crunch the numbers mostly by hand, right? Mm-hmm. So they would somehow, those women or men who good at numbers, right? But they would still crunch it through Excel, right? But what we did was we took those their early Excel sheets or whatever, we threw them into the database, and then we crunched the numbers for the years back, right? And created some models that knew how to calculate those things, because the in Slovenia, and I guess probably everywhere, is a split who owns the network, the uh-huh. electric network, and who provides the electricity, right? Uh-huh. So let's say you're in Ljubljana, right? Uh-huh. You don't have to grab the electricity from the closest Ljubljana's uh-huh. electricity provider. You can grab it from, I don't know, from up north or whatever. But then, of course, you have to use somewhere else's network, but you have to pay for it, right? But then you can somehow calculate all those things in. So it's if that provider from the north gives you a better price and what you pay for the usage of the network is less than what you would pay for the provider in Ljubljana, but the network is his and it's closer or something like that. So all those things mattered. So you had the thing is like it wasn't as hard. It wasn't like a super hard problem to solve because there's not many providers and there's not many network owners. Uh-huh. But still, right? You had to, and all those companies, like I told you before, they had to do it in advance. And what we did was we somehow we'll get paid for whatever we save you from before, right? Uh-huh. Percentage of the saved money, right? What the app also did was, okay, you could tell this is as much of electricity you will buy for, I don't know, I think it was like a week or a month, I don't know how it was, but if you somehow went over, because it was monitoring things all the time. Uh-huh. So it's somehow it was alerting and you could alert them all year. You're pretty much, if there's like a bad winter, like really, really cold, of course, more electricity, you consume more electricity. As we predicted, right? We couldn't predict that it would be like a really, yeah. really cold winter, right? And you consumed more electricity than expected. We somehow alerted you and you switched from the normal provider, you switched to gas, right? You were able to have those uh-huh. your own aggregates. And you turned those on, and you were still, you were consuming oil or gasoline, right? But you didn't peak, because if you peaked, you had to pay big penalties. You didn't want to go above what you predicted, right?
Uh-huh. This is an interesting system, actually. Really interesting. Yeah, so I think you like it because of the math as well, right?
Yeah, there was still some math in the back, right?
Interestingly, I was at the same time, I was involved in almost identical system in Germany, and we migrated from C to Java and actually to JBoss back then. This was one of the earliest JBoss projects and problems as well, because lots of problems. But there also for power plants, even with visualization of the entire stuff. And it was also interesting. So there were like the old system was C and C++, and they wanted to have Java and spend some time there.
Yeah, I mean, I went at one point. When the thing was, this app was getting bigger and bigger. So if you can somehow imagine, it was a Tomcat on steroids with Spring, right? And it was...
But wasn't... back then, Spring... back then at the beginning, someone showed me a Spring, as I always did Java in J2E. But I look at this, and the amount of XML, I didn't like it. So I say, okay, this is really crazy. So why we should do this? So, and this is why I never use Spring, actually, because and then early this JBoss project was all right. They extended JBoss like crazy back then. And later I was Glassfish, but I think since 2005, I never had XML again. So I just removed all XML and we used a convention of a configuration, basically. We inject at EJB and this was enough. And you liked it, Spring and XML back then?
Yeah, I mean, you were able, because we had for different, of course, different providers. The app was... Most of the app was like a SaaS, right? The mm-hmm. service, software as a service mm-hmm. for like smaller providers. But those big consumers, they had their own stuff on premise, right? So you were able to, we had to do a switch of configuration for them.
It makes sense. This was one of the Vue project where, because in my project was like if and impl, and there was no second impl, you know? It's like, why are you doing this? It's like crazy what I saw, right? So it was, yeah. Okay, I get it. So there was then you had the added value. And how long you worked for the company?
What was it, like 2000, the end of 2002?
Wow, that's pretty long actually, right?
2002, no, like 4 years. And then at 2006, it's like actually a funny story how I joined JBoss, right? Mm-hmm. It was JBoss, but it was also already transitioning into Red Hat.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't. I mean,
and why you joined JBoss and didn't stick with the company?
Once you get an offer to join JBoss, it's different than working for for a local company, right? You get an offer from Mark Fleury, you don't say no, right?
Oh, from Mark?
Yeah.
He was also on the podcast. This was actually a really interesting guy.
Yeah. He was a super interesting guy. I mean, it's an interesting story how I came about, right? That's
How Mark found you?
Yeah, I mean, it was actually Bill Berg that found me, but I was, as I told you, like we had this app, mm-hmm. and it was Tomcat on steroids with Spring, mm-hmm. and at one point I saw that I was solving, I was pushing in JMS, JCA, all sorts of stuff into the Tomcat through Spring. Uh-huh. And I came to learn about JBoss even before, but somehow I was like, oh yeah, probably that's too much for what we need. But at one point I was like, yeah, okay, I'm solving the problems that JBoss solves out of the box, right? It comes with all those things already uh-huh. in, right? I don't have to solve it on my own. I can configure it through those MBeans, I can configure database pool or database connection pool, JPA, JMS, whatever I could, all the transactions, all the remote stuff, and so on, right? I don't need to do that on my own through somehow even more Frankensteining the Tomcat.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh.
And I moved to JBoss, right?
Uh-huh.
But then I was stuck with bunch of and at that time it was already JBoss, like it was JBoss 3,
uh-huh.
but there was already early days of like a preview of JBoss 4, which uh-huh. came with EJB's 3, which we were able to inject
exactly.
Yeah, but I was stuck with a couple of hundred of Spring Beans, right, which I still wanted to use. And what I did was I learned about how JBoss internally works. Right? I went through the code and see how it works. And I saw, okay, it's like a cool notion of deployers. Right? You could add your own deployer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, okay, I can add my own. So I'll have a Spring deployer,
mm-hmm.
which would scan for those minus bins XML files. Uh-huh. It will learn about them. And it would know, and it would create the bins, and it would know. So you were able to mix and match EJBs. You were able to inject Spring bins into EJBs and vice versa.
Sounds almost like Quarkus extension.
Yeah, sort of. And I wrote that, right? So, and I was able to, migrate the app a lot easier that way, right? Instead of just throwing away all the Spring bins and creating EJBs out of them and so on. It was nice because I had all this configuration which I didn't want to, you don't want to throw away, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in 2005, I think it was, I was sort of like sent to Java 1 in San Francisco.
Wow. By yes, Red Hat or by the...
No, by the company. So it's like a, almost like a reward for good work and so on.
The energy company. So the, yeah. So the energy company grew...
Yeah, yeah, we were growing, right? We, from the early days in end of 2002 till then, it was probably 5 to 6 programmers, two product managers.
But you are from the beginning there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
This is a good feeling. I mean,
yeah, it was good, right?
Yeah, it's just like if the team is great and you are from the beginning, this is a unique experience, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, those were really interesting days as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I was sent to Java, and I saw there's like a talk on JBoss forum, mm-hmm. and the new EJBs, etc. And it's like done by Bill Burke.
Mm-hmm. Just and quite Bill a character. The Bill also did the Rest Easy for JBoss.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Korba. He liked Korba, I remember. And yeah, he really disliked Rest at the beginning.
He came from a company that was using Korba back in the days and then joined JBoss on top of it, right? Mm-hmm. So he was doing the talk about JBoss 4, and at one point he mentions this cool new like feature, the deployers, right? And he said, okay, we have deployer for this and this and this, and you can extend it, you can add your own deployer. For example, you can add a Spring, because Spring was quite popular at that time, and he's mentioned, like, you can add a Spring deployer. And I was like, oh, damn, how could I miss? Like, I didn't have a laptop then, I didn't have internet, and of course, I had to. And I was sort of like, how could I miss it? I mean, why would I go and implement my own if there was already one there, right? Like, how could I miss it? I mean, I thought I knew JBoss, mm-hmm. all the JBoss stuff that was there. So I came back. The first thing that I did was like, went through all the possible code, all the stuff that was around JBoss and so on, and I couldn't find it. So I said, oh, what the heck? I mean, I'll write an email to Bill, right? Bill, hi, I was at your talk, interesting mm-hmm. talk. You mentioned Spring Deployer. I'm looking for it, but I couldn't find it. And I'm interested, like, Bill replied quite quickly. So he's like, good, yeah. But I mentioned that Spring Deployer just like an example in theory, what you could do. And I wrote him back, wow, no, theory, I already have it. You really do, right? And I sent him, like, could you share that stuff? I mean, okay, I said, at that time, it wasn't no GitHub, no...
Yeah, SourceForge back then, big time.
Yeah, yeah.
And Google Code, not Google Code. You know what was the name? There was a SourceForge, and there was another name, something with house, Codehouse or something like this.
Codehouse, yeah, and Google Code as well, right? You could put it on Google Code. Mm-hmm. And then I zipped the whole, I mean, I had it like in a separate module, right? And I zipped it and I sent it to him so he could see what I did. And he was like, wow, that's amazing. That's exactly how I want it to be done, right? Mm-hmm. And can you actually share this code? Can you make it a JBoss module, right? I mean, okay, I said I have to ask the owners, but they didn't know, right, whatever was going on. Yeah, yeah, sure, whatever. Do whatever you want, right? So I created a module inside JBoss, and JBoss Spring Deployer was one of the modules, right?
It's a cool story, actually. And to the owners, so you had a good relation to the owners, more like friends back then, or?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, when I left, we didn't actually live in really the best terms, but yeah, later on we reconnected somehow. So it was
Okay. Good. And and then what happened? Bill Burke offered you a job, or?
No, I mean, at first I did all sorts of things around, because that was quite an instant thing somehow to join the two worlds together, right? Mm-hmm. Spring and JBoss, I mean, they didn't like each other at that time and probably still don't. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's like an interesting story behind it. So you can join the two worlds, right? You can join Spring Beans with JBoss 4, right? Mm-hmm. So I did an article in an interesting magazine. It went online as well. At one point, I was invited to JBoss World in Las Vegas to do a talk on top of it.
How big was it?
JBoss World at that time. Mm-hmm. I think couple of thousand people.
Wow. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think it was like 2,000, something like that. I mean, it was something like you had talks from all JBoss people, and I did a talk on this Spring stuff that I did. I mean, in between, I was already contributing to other stuff as well, right? I was because I was using we are using Spring JBoss portal, so whatever something wasn't working, I just created a patch for it. JBoss itself, right? Mm-hmm. The JBoss 4, and what else? I think you know some Hibernate stuff. I mean, everything that you are using, and it wasn't, I mean, I remember at the company, we didn't have lots of money to buy the software, so the open source was like the best for us.
Yeah.
And to be on the cutting edge, I somehow just had written down revisions of the commits which we were using, right?
Yeah.
So that was how we versioned our software. So I knew, okay, we are running on JBoss 4, commit revision, this and this. So we knew in similar with Hibernate, in similar with JBoss portal and so on, right? Anyway, so yeah, I mean, I was contributing all sorts of it. And then after the talk, after my presentation at JBoss World.
About the deployers?
Yeah, the deployers, yeah. Uh-huh. Mark came, Bill Burke came, Scott Stark, and Adrian Brock.
Uh-huh.
And they somehow asked me, would you like to do that for a living, like 8 hours a day?
Okay.
And so, yeah, so, and don't say no, right? So,
yeah,
I still, I mean, I couldn't just leave immediately, right? It's not like in the US. So I had to give a formal notice. I mean, it took 3 months to finish the work here. But yeah, mm-hmm. then I joined. It was like on the 1st of December 2006. So it's like, what, 19 years.
This is an incredible. I didn't actually knew that, but I knew that Mark was quite a character back then. He was very, almost like a Steve Jobs a little bit, right? Unconventional. Yeah. And
I mean, he had a aura, right? And he had a charisma. So you, I mean, when something like that says, if you want to join, you don't say no, right?
Yeah.
Plus, I mean, they, I mean, even like money wise, it was, I mean, they had some problems to figure out how to actually employ me or how to get me paid.
Yeah, exactly. I remember they at the beginning, I think there was training and documentation, right? This was the idea.
Yeah,
and then was support. And yeah, what you did at JBoss? What was your assignment actually?
Yeah, when I started, I mean, they offered me, okay, you can choose because there were other people that wanted me on their projects from what was like JBoss Portal or JBoss itself, AS or even Hibernate Search or something like that. But I mean, I was looking into how the JBoss kernel, like previously, it was like a extension of JMX, right? It was like a kernel on top of JMX,
yeah.
Abusing the JMX as a kernel. But at that time, they were rewriting the kernel into more of like a bean approach and even be even more pluggable, even so on. So that was the microcontainer. It was developed by solely or like mostly by Adrian Brock. I mean, he was a genius behind it, and he was like a really smart guy. I mean, he was a nice guy, but programming-wise, he was intimidating people, not like in an ugly way, but yeah, he was so precise, so good, that and he was following all the stuff that's going on, and if he didn't like something, he would let you know, right? in a nice way, right? But it wasn't like an ugly, like he would be obnoxious or something like that.
Yeah.
But you never knew, but because he was following everything, he's like a, had a like a, from Subversion, there was, of course, every commit in Subversion, they were joined into a mailing list, and you were able to subscribe to that mailing list, so you were able to see all the commits. It was crazy how he was following everything. So if somebody did something that he didn't like, he would let you know, right? So people were most like scared of him in a way, right? But I said, like, I wanted to learn from the best, and I wanted to join the microcontainer project.
Mm-hmm.
But then he said, okay, fine. I mean, I'll give you a task, and then I'll see how you handle it. If I'll be pleased, you can join my team. Okay, like a team of one.
Oh, this is with the Adrian.
Adrian Brock. Mm-hmm. And then he somehow forgot and sending me, hey Adrian, here I'm waiting for your task so that I can. And he wrote like three things, and I thought, okay, all those three things were tasks, and I solved them all. Plus, I fixed some of his bugs. But then he saw, like, he was looking at it, and he just said, oh yeah, I thought you were just one of the three things was a task, not all three.
Okay.
And yeah, so he was like, yeah, we should get this guy on board. I mean, he solved all three things that I gave him. Yeah, so I started off with a microcontainer, and it was really lots of fun.
So you worked on the core of JBoss, actually.
Yeah, of JBoss 5 and 6.
Mm-hmm. And how was Adrian? So you had fun with him?
Yeah, I mean, we were both guys who studied maths and were both like quite precise and pain in the ass if something wasn't done properly or something. And plus, I mean, learning from him, it's like some of the things that he said, if you don't have a test for it, it doesn't work, right? So half of the project were tests, right? So we had to test every single thing, every single detail. We had to have a test for it.
But not getters and setters, hopefully.
No. Not those stupid things. But yeah, like proper,
proper right.
Test for the functionality. So remember, you can, from the core, you had to do all sorts of funky class loading,
mm-hmm.
all sorts of funky configuration, all those like injections, deployment ordering, deployment parsing, etc. Like even the supporting, we had to support, of course, we didn't just control it away. We had the new microcontainer bins. We still had to support the old JMX
mm-hmm.
bins, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we somehow had an abstraction of component models inside the core, and you were able to mix and match
mm-hmm.
JMX beans with normal beans, and then EJBs were also part of the. You could also inject EJB beans, and of course, I rewrote my Spring deployer into that as well, so you were able to have Spring beans. So it's like a.
What I did, I took a look how EJBs are working on JBoss, and I remember they were like, for entity beans, 14 invocation handlers, because it was transactions and so forth, lazy loading and stuff like that. But I don't know whether it was the new micro container or the older JMX container. I suppose the older JMX, because I was, you could actually see in the configuration all the layers, so you can activate and deactivate the layers. And also the invoker in EJB was pluggable. So you could have even EJBs via HTTP, the protocol, right? So you could swap.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, I think that was the old one. You had the invoker bin, right? And you were able to add your own stack, your own invoker, I mean, your own like interceptor into it, right?
Mm-hmm.
The invoker, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and you're still working on the kernel right now?
No.
So when you stop, to work on the JBoss, microcontainer, and what was your next assignment?
Yeah, when I was done with JBoss 5 and JBoss 6, they're running on the microcontainer.
Mm-hmm.
But we saw, I think the thing was, it was nice. It was like super pluggable. It was like crazy stuff, but it was somehow over-engineered.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was still, at the end. So, with all the things that we did, it mm-hmm. was booting too slow. Right,
mm-hmm.
because we were somehow scanning all things, creating all those beans mm-hmm. Through scanning and blah blah and so on. So, and then of course Glassfish was coming behind. Right, it was on top of OAG, and it was more of like an exact. So it booted up in a couple of seconds, where it was taking for us to boot in like 30 seconds. Right,
mm-hmm.
so.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, internally, we decided to move from this, and we, like, JBoss 7 was a completely new kernel. I did some of it, but not a lot of it. Then I moved to the CDI to be part of the Weld team. So I implemented parts of Weld. Yeah, and then after Weld, I mean, after Weld, it was like probably the most interesting or most enjoyable. I mean, I enjoyed it all, right? But at one point when we were mostly done with Weld, or at least I was done with Weld, because most of the stuff was implemented. So I could somehow take some time off to, not completely time off, but just to see and play with other things. And I came across Google App Engine. And I was playing with Google App Engine.
Google App Engine, but this was late. When was it? I mean, which year?
Google App Engine was probably 2010, 2011.
Yeah, exactly. And but this was later right now, right? What, Jabber 7 was later than 2010, no?
No, I think not.
Okay.
I mean...
But Google App Engine, it's a big thing, and this is actually now implemented by a Glassfish guy. Interesting.
Yeah, the French guys, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So I was playing with Google App Engine, and I mean, I was doing an interesting app, like on my own with my friends, just playing around with some of it. And I was quite frustrated by the fact that when I was doing things locally, it was, my app was working, but when I deployed it, it had so much more limitations that the local SDK didn't expose, right? I don't know, the limits on transactions, the limits on, I don't know, all sorts of things, what you could do and how much it took to boot up and so on. So the local SDK didn't somehow take that in consideration, but when you deployed, so my app was like crashing all the time, and so on. It's like, oh, that's really frustrating to have such bad local SDK, right? You could probably do a lot better, right? And I started playing, and I said, what if I implemented API, like the Google App Engine API, on my own inside the Jabber 7, right? And I started off, I said, okay, let me see what's the hardest API, and I guess it's the data store is the hardest, right, to get it right with how to actually do the data store and do the transactions and so on. And I started playing with that, and I saw, I mean, I had an idea how to do it. So yeah, I quickly created a proof of concept. I mean, like did a quick stuff that, like a prototype that worked. And I showed it at one point, I don't know where we were, I think we were in Boston or something like that. And I pulled Mark Little aside and I said, Mark, have a minute. I mean, I have this stuff that I've been playing around with. And Google App Engine was quite popular.
Very popular back then.
Yeah,
right.
It's not anymore as popular, or not even popular. But at that time, it was quite popular. And I pulled him aside and I said, okay, I have this. And he was like, yeah, okay, show it to me. And I showed him how you can just, and I took an example app from the Google App Engine site, right, which was doing some data store, and I just dropped it in Jabber 7, and it worked, right? And it's like, you're running Jabber 7, right? Yeah, I'm running Jabber 7. This is an app that we took from Google App Engine site, right? It's a VAR that's working, right? He said, okay, nice, nice. And he actually gave me additional resource. And he said, okay, nice. Okay, do you have anything smarter or better to do, more important? I said, like, yeah, the Weld is mostly done, so I have the time. He said, okay, yeah, do you need some help? So I'm like, yeah, I guess it's, I just started with one API and there's like 30 APIs, right? Plus, you probably have to test it a lot. And I got resources, and I was able to sort of hire a person, and that person was a friend of mine from high school. So, yeah, he was helping me, and the project is called Cape Dwarf.
Never heard about it. This is what I missed, completely missed.
Yeah, so, I mean, we implemented all the API.
Was it used in JBoss? Were there some people using that?
Yeah, I mean, there were some users outside. I mean, the thing was like, it was never really, I mean, there was a push, so we blogged about it, we tweeted about it. So there we had, and so JBoss was somehow pushing it. So there was like a serious project with all the PR behind it. So, and we had users, right? We had users from also like, and even like, the thing was, you were able to create, I mean, we implemented it properly. So we implemented a, like a, almost 2000 tests for it, which was later turned into a TCK, which was then also used. At one point, Google gave me 5 people to work on the TCK, right?
Wow.
Yeah.
Google?
Yeah, Google gave me 5 people to work on TCK. So we implemented tests properly so that you could run the same tests against any kind of App Engine, Google App Engine implementation, right? Either the local SDK, either like the production on the AppSpot or Cape Wharf, or there were some other guys in California that were also doing their own implementation of
App. This is interesting because I guess Google said, okay, you could have a local Google App Engine experience, right, as a test, right?
Yeah, exactly.
This was the goal. They knew about that.
I always started off when we were writing the test. So we turned our internal tests for the Cape Wharf, we turned them into like a proper TCK, right? Because I was already running things on top of with Arkillion. So what I did was also just had to do was I had to implement Arkillion containers for local App Engine SDK, for remote App Engine, for the AppSpot, and Arkillion container for the fourth one, something like that. So yeah, I was able to run the same set of tests through Arkillion, just having a proper Arkillion container on the class pad, and it was running against any kind of App Engine implementation.
Super cool. And then the project was successful, and you moved on to different tasks, I assume, right?
Yeah. I mean, so it was an interesting story. So that was. I told you about the kitten, like the 1 billion kitten, and the company was like the.
You told me. So we met at Ljubljana GenAI workshop and conference. This was like LLM, and you told me that we were in the kind of a museum in Ljubljana, which looked interesting. So it was like a hackerspace, and you told me that there is a 1 billion idea with the kitten, right? Kitten app, which was implemented in Slovenia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that kitten app was running on top of App Engine.
Ah.
So, and at one point, I had a talk in Lugano, the Faculty of Computer Science, right? I had a talk about Cape Wharf, presented Cape Wharf. And the people from this company came to me and they said, like, yeah, we're running all our stuff on App Engine, right? So, the kitten was a mobile app. But there was, of course, the ad stuff and poking so that all the statistics, all the metrics for the app were collected through the App Engine app. And they said, yeah, we have problems. We don't know because there's like a concurrency problem with us. It only shows in production, right? We're not able to replicate it locally because the local App Engine didn't know how to cluster, right? They didn't know how to have multiple instances. And they said, like, but you showed us how you can do a cluster of apps in a cluster of Google App Engine, right, through Cape Wharf. Because it was running on top of JBoss, clustering was out of the box, right? Just had to properly implement it. You're able to run Cape Wharf in a cluster, and they deployed their app locally, and they were able to find the bug, the concurrency bug.
That's a cool story, actually.
Yeah.
And you quit the Cape Wharf because the project was done.
Yeah, I mean, at one point we had all the APIs, and somehow it somehow lost some focus, or the project lost the focus. Not me, but you can tell that we're trying to somehow sell it for a couple of years, and like 3-4 years, it didn't catch up as much as we wanted, right? Because at least things went into the other direction. I mean, it's somehow, I don't know how we would say it's that it sang out, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then I moved, yeah, to other things. We were somehow familiarized with Kubernetes before it was even publicly announced, right? Uh-huh. Because we were doing OpenShift. We bought Makara. Makara was already doing some cloud with,
Because interestingly, the first OpenShift was not Kubernetes based. Then it was migrated to Kubernetes.
Mm-hmm. I think version 1 and 2 were already, it was based on top of what Makara did, like the company that Red Hat bought.
It was Ruby based, right?
Yeah.
Ruby, and I did with JBoss. It was more like Heroku experience. You can push to a GitHub, and it was automatically deployed behind the scenes. I remember.
I actually did some work on top of it. It was what we now call containers. They called it gears. Mm-hmm. And there was some Ruby, some Groovy, some bunch of Bash scripts, and so on. Compared to Kubernetes, once you learned about Kubernetes, you just let go of everything else, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And what I did then was we had to somehow integrate JBoss and Red Hat products like JBoss EAP or DataGrid or the knowledge engine or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. Into the first clouds, into the OpenShift, with all sorts of EMQ, I remember EMQ as well, with all sorts of means that we somehow knew how to do, right? The early OpenShift days, it was quite hard. It was like Frankensteining the things pushing them into it. But with Kubernetes or OpenShift as an extension of Kubernetes, things were much easier. There were some things that you had to do. For example, of course, it changed how you do clustering, right? You're not able, because of the limitations of the networking, you're not able to do a multicast. Mm-hmm. So you had to create your own, but there was like a thing. Yeah, the J groups stuff was done by Belaban. There it was like extendable, so you could do. And our create was like a K ping, so somehow push the information into the key value table stuff, and then the other implementations grabbed it out and so on, right? Sorts of small things to somehow make the transition of users which were using JBoss just seamless. They didn't even know that they were running inside Kubernetes, right? Or inside OpenShift, right? That was the idea.
This should be... what I did back then is I was asked by Red Hat to create a OpenShift JBoss workshop, I think. JBoss, yeah. And at the same time, I noticed someone told me they're working on something which I would like. And this was Quarkus. It was at that time, right?
Quarkus was 2018, right?
Something like this. This was the beginning, and maybe I noticed Quarkus 2019 or something like this.
Uh-huh. Yeah, in between with doing this, one thing was that crypto boom in Slovenia was huge, right? It was really, really popular. So, at one point, not really bored, but yeah, you could say I'm bored with stuff. And I got a really interesting offer from a Slovenian startup to do a crypto exchange and so on. Mm-hmm. So for a year, I moved away from Red Hat.
Ah.
So I somehow missed the early days of Quarkus, right?
Mm-hmm. So you missed, you left Red Hat at the OpenShift timeline and then...
After OpenShift timeline, it was like, I think it was what, early, all right, it was 2000, I think it was like, or was it 2018, I think, something like that, early, mm-hmm. end of 2017, early 2018, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We did some interesting stuff for the crypto thing.
In Java, hopefully.
Yeah, of course.
Oh,
Java, cool. And because we didn't know about Quarkus then, because it's still like a stealth project, uh-huh. we did everything on Spring Boot. But uh-huh. we used Kafka a lot. I mean, you are abusing Kafka for everything, right?
Yeah, so Kafka is almost a blockchain part of it.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, we were abusing Kafka a lot at that company, at that startup. But I mean, at one point, yeah, just, I mean, I didn't like the crypto world as much as I thought. I mean, we grew apart from the owners and us, the developers. So after a year, I moved away.
To Red Hat, back to Red Hat.
Yeah, of course. I mean, at one point I was pinging them because we were using Kafka a lot, and you were using how to put Kafka on top of Google Cloud, because you were using Google Cloud. What would be the easiest way? I mean, and we took Streamzy, right? Mm-hmm. We took Streamzy, we added Kafka on top of Google Cloud through Streamzy. Mm-hmm. But we were running on all sorts of, if it was like a easy thing, everything worked. But when we were really, you can imagine, since we were doing crypto exchange, hash exchange, right? Mm-hmm. We had to, at least even in the test phase before we went to production, we had to burden things a lot, stress it under a huge load. And once we did that, we got into all sorts of problems with Kafka and Streamzy, right? Probably mostly because of Streamzy. Some of them we were able to solve, some of them not. Mm-hmm. I mean, we even crashed a Google Cloud computer, which they weren't able to solve back. Yeah. So there's like the 99.999% SLA. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we managed to get that 0.0001.
Not bad. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so bad. I mean, they couldn't get the data back. So if it was in production and some of the stuff, I mean, it was like that was pushing money around, like crypto money, but it was still money, right? Mm-hmm. we wouldn't be able to save all of it, right? Mm-hmm. To some extent, right, where we would have the logs, you were able to get it back, but probably some of the stuff, we crashed. Mm-hmm. And at one point, I asked the guys, like I knew from before, like the Red Hat guys, even in between, can you give us support for Streamzy on Google Cloud? And they said, unfortunately, no, we can just do it if you move to OpenShift. Yeah, but we don't want to move to OpenShift. We don't want to have things on-premise. We just want to host things in Google Cloud so that everything is easier for us, right? Yeah, fortunately, no. But when I came, I even had a presentation on all the problems that we had with Streamzy and how we solved it and all the pain points and what people should be aware of. And it came to the knowledge of Red Hat people back. And I left in good terms. I just said, okay, I want to try something else. I didn't do nothing against. I mean, I loved being at Red Hat. I said nothing against. So we left on good terms. And Mark Little always said, you can always come back. And I pinged him and he said, I'll ask around. And of course, the Streamzy guys jumped on it immediately. Oh, yeah, Alesh, yeah, he did that Streamzy stuff.
Okay.
So it'll definitely be a good contribution to the team.
So it's actually a good idea if you're passionate about something, you know, just to do the work up front and then you can get better hired or easier hired, right? So
yeah, plus, if you do a presentation and people learn about it. And But yeah, then a couple of years at Streamzy. I was always more like a runtime guy, right? I mean, I love the stuff at the Streamzy. But like I said, from the early days, of course, like, JBoss 4, 5, 6, Weld as a, and so on, Cavedwarf as a runtime, right? When there was an opening in Quarkus, I jumped to that opportunity, and here I am.
Very good. So I think we should stop here, and I will re-invite you back, and we can talk a little bit more about Quarkus, because it's also interesting what happens there. And And where people can find you on the internet?
I'm not really a Twitter guy, but yeah, you can still tweet me. I will get something, but probably the easiest, you can just email me if you have any. You can find it under commits, or it's alex.justin@gmail.com, right? You can just email me directly. I try to, I mean, if there's, I'll answer. Or, I mean, probably, but the easiest is the stuff that I do. It's like Quarkus, Reactive, mostly gRPC and observability and so on. Just open up, and if you have something like issues, that's probably the easiest and the best channel, so we can follow the progress and whatever, like anybody else that can pitch in. But from the old stuff, yeah, it's mostly it's like, I would say it's deprecated, I mean, not deprecated, but yeah, Cape Dwarf, you can still check like capedwarf.org, right? I'll send you the link.
Okay, we do.
Yeah, but
thank you a lot.
It's end of line, right? So.
And see you next time.
Okay. Thanks. See ya. Bye-bye.